Very welcome, everybody, especially Dr. White. He's stopping over, as I'm sure some of you know already, on his way back from a cruise in Europe to the United States. He takes off on Monday morning from Heathrow. He's here today and tomorrow, and then gone, well, here today, gone tomorrow, but tomorrow morning, Walter, so he will be here for give a third lecture after Mass tomorrow morning. It's strange and not strange that Catholics would gather to think about Dickens. Dr. White gave many lectures on Shakespeare to the seminarians in Winona, and the seminarians appreciated them enormously, because this education in the classics had been lacking completely in their modern schooling, virtually completely. There was a kind of lip service to Macbeth and Julius Caesar, perhaps, but the teachers weren't convinced and it didn't really mean anything. But when Dr. White taught Shakespeare, the seminarians really perked up, because it was a bridge between, he used the Shakespeare as a bridge between the faith and the modern world. There's such a distance that the modern world slips every day further and further away from the faith. But the classics are a kind of literature, it's a kind of bridge between the two. And they appreciated that very much, because the doctor's special gift is to relate the classics to the faith and to the modern world, make them act exactly as a bridge. I think that's what you will most likely find in what he will say about Dickens, who, of course, is very associated with Broadstairs. He often came here in the 19th century with his family to holiday and also to work. He wrote many of his, a few of his well-known works were composed in part or good part here in Broadstairs, because he loved it. He loved it so much. And I think maybe if you take the opportunity this afternoon later to stroll a little in town, you'll see why he loved it. I'd like to introduce all of you, if I may, to Mr. Richard Lewis, who is amongst us today, a complete stranger in theory, but he wrote these two little lovely little booklets about, called Artistic Thanet. Thanet is this part of the world, this corner of northeast Kent, and there are a lot of distinguished writers and painters in particular that gravitated to this corner. The two most famous are the poet T.S. Eliot, who wrote in Margate a good part of his very famous poem, The Wasteland, and J.A.W.M. Turner, who was a boy here in Margate, also Margate also, and learned colour from the sunset and the sunrise in Margate. The colours, and somebody said to me just the other day that the colours are sensational in Margate. I don't know why they should be, but they certainly stayed with Turner all his days. The most famous of all, perhaps Dickens, Charles Dickens here in Broadstairs. Samuel Taylor Coleridge was also in Ramsgate. You have 12, no less than 12, in these two little booklets. Mr. Lewis is going to leave behind a few copies, and if any of you are interested in how and why and who they were that came to this part of the world and made themselves famous, John Buchan, Van Gogh, briefly, Wilkie Collins, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, T.S. Eliot, Coleridge, a Jewish painter, Solomon, and a French painter, James Tissot. Not well known, but a very, very touching story of his being here in Ramsgate for particular reasons, and then leaving the great tears in his heart. Read all about it. It's a marvellous little corner of the world, quite a special little corner of England, and Dr. White is going to tell us about Dickens.
Thank you. Many of you who read the weekly Elaison comments are aware, and not surprisingly, given His Excellency's love of poetry, that he's begun putting little snippets of poetry at the end of many of the comments. So in fairness, I thought I should retaliate and begin these talks with little snippets of poetry that I'm proud to say are not nearly as learned or fine as his own. So being a cranky American of small talent, I've resorted to my Irish roots and have come up with limericks. A Catholic bishop came to Broadstairs, and from his flock always inspired awed stares. His devotion to truth gave them evident proof. He only cared for what God cares. And that's certainly true. Anyway, thank you, Your Excellency. Happy to be here. Happy to be here. I'm going to begin with something a little out of, well, no, first, before I even get to the talk, forget the talk. I have to complain. His Excellency was talking about what's happening in the modern world, especially with the teaching of the arts and the rest of it. Let's go beyond that. That the modern world has gone stark, raving mad. And I want to give you a recent example. Aside from the fact that I was hit by a car this morning in London trying to get here, it was a minor injury and I will recover quickly. We got out of the taxi cab and I was trying to get my luggage and the car backed into me. But a small price to pay for such a lovely place and a lovely day. But the hotel that I stayed in last night in London was the most expensive hotel I have ever stayed in my life. Fortunately, I wasn't paying for the night's stay. I couldn't possibly have been there. And it was also far and away the worst establishment I've ever stayed in my life. When I was a young man and first came to Europe, I stayed in a tiny little room in a flop house in Paris and became very fond of the cockroaches. But last night's experience was dreadful. The reason was this. As soon as I walked in, it was a very modern hotel. All steel and plexiglass and flashing lights and bore no resemblance to any hotel I'd ever seen in my life. Got to the room and realized, of course, they no longer have room keys. They have these cards you use. Well, I was used to taking the card and sticking it in a little slot and the door would open. And I looked and there's no slot anywhere in the door to put a key. At which point I looked on the card and it said something about wireless woo-woo vibrations. So I began moving the card around the lock and at some point the door opened. I couldn't tell you how. Walked in and of course the lights couldn't be turned on. Couldn't find where the lights were. Finally managed to turn some lights on, and from that point on, the lights could not be turned off. Finally, it came to the point where my friend and I had to unplug the lights in order to shut them off. And since we had to catch an early train this morning, I looked at the little alarm clock in the room to set the alarm. There were at least, on top of the clock, about a dozen buttons which would increase or decrease the intensity of the light behind the time. You could increase or decrease the volume of the alarm or the radio that would come on. You could do all sorts of other magical things. I think maybe start the coffee maker or perhaps turn the lights off. I didn't attempt it. And I suddenly realized there was no button for setting the hour or the minutes, either in the time or the alarm. And they had a little tiny remote thing there as well that had about 24 little buttons on it, none of which hour or minute. So you could not change the time or set the alarm. So I just want to thank my guardian angel for waking me up in time to get me here this morning. And guardian angels are much more useful than any modern conveniences. So that's an important lesson to begin with. I'm going to start with something that I think is necessary. His Excellency hinted at it, and it's something that's been much on my mind lately. And as you know, eventually I will get to my subject. You can just put it down to my going gaga. You'll notice I'm seated now. I always used to stand, but the sticks are getting a little shaky, maybe because I'm becoming top-heavy. No, to be fair, because I've always been middle-heavy. But in any case, Some of you know that currently, and I'm delighted to do this, I'm working on a biography of His Excellency. And it's coming along slowly, but consistently. But right now I'm writing a little section, and I think extremely important, because there's been another outbreak of this. I've spoken of it in the past on occasion, but because of the recent outbreak, which is, reaching epidemic proportion, I'd like to bring it up again. For too many traditional Catholics, there is almost a stock response when you say to them, I'm going to do some lectures on Dickens, and I think you should be reading Dickens. And the response is this: was he Catholic? And if you say, well, no, actually he wasn't a Catholic, the response is, well, then why should we be reading him? Fill in the blank. There are countless other names you could put in there. Many of the greatest writers that are well worth reading. But there is this curious sense that only Catholic writers are worth reading. Well, here's my response, and I wish you to spread this, if you would, please. My cranky response is now this. Do you make the same demand of the baker who bakes your bread? If you were to walk into a very fine bakery, and there were beautiful loaves of bread, and some very nice pies and tarts, and some lovely cakes, and some splendid cookies, before you bought them, would you say to the baker, are you Catholic? Because I only buy bread from Catholic bakers. My sense is the idea wouldn't even occur to anyone. Or let's assume your shoes have worn out and there are big holes in the bottom of your shoes, and shoes being expensive, you no longer want to go out and buy a new pair of shoes when your shoes wear out. You want to have them resold. So you know that in your town is a very good, very competent shoemaker who will resole your shoes at a decent price. And you take your shoes in and you show him the holes in the bottom of your shoe and you say, can you resole my shoes? And he says, I certainly can, and I'll do it for this price. And you say, fine, but first, before you do it, are you Catholic? And he says, no, I'm not. You take your shoes and you throw them away and you walk barefoot. Or to carry it even a step further, you're driving your car and you come to a bridge and you stop at the edge of the bridge and begin to do research to find out if the engineers who built that bridge were Catholic. Because if they weren't Catholic engineers, you don't want to drive across that bridge. I only drive across bridges that were engineered, designed, and built by Catholic engineers. Well, you'll sit at the side of the road for a long while. I don't mean to be mean-spirited, although I have to admit to being a little cranky. And my point is this. God did not distribute his gifts only to Catholics. As Catholics, we believe firmly in what is called the mystical body of Christ, and being in the church, we are very fortunate to be part of that mystical body. But even within the church and within Christ's mystical body, each of us has been given a different and very important and selective role to play. And if I decided, even within the mystical body, I was going to spend my time baking bread or repairing shoes or building bridges, the world would be in trouble. What I've been given, God be praised and thanked, a gift for in my career is to read literature, love literature, and talk about literature. And that's what I think I was supposed to do and what I've done. Now, God as well, outside of the immediate mystical body of Christ, which is the church, give his gifts to many other individuals. And it may or may not have been his intent. Well, of course, it's his intention that they should all become part of the mystical body. But they are also given free will and can choose to do so or not. And if they do not make that choice, it does not mean that God has withdrawn or hindered the gift he gave them. So that when we read, we should read the greatest writers. And even if a great writer is not of the Catholic faith, that writer is great for two reasons. One, the writer is telling us something about the time in which he lived and giving us a sense of what that world was like, recreating a time, a place, an atmosphere so that it will be there in later times to understand what happened. One of the glories of Dickens is he lets us see and understand in a profound way 19th century England. It was his world, and he delivers it spectacularly well with depth, with joy, with passion, with compassion, and as a result, we have much to learn about that world from reading him. And number two, it shouldn't be number two, it should be number one. This is the most important thing. And you ask it about any writer. Does this writer tell the truth? Because if the writer is telling profound truths, then that writer is touching something that is eternal and good. And if the writer can tell those eternal truths and do so beautifully and with a sense of the good, then there is embodied in that writing something that is indeed God-given, timeless, eternal, and we thank God for it. As a result, we read those writers that are time-tested, time-approved, that told the truth, that give us their age, that others have read, that others that we know are specialists in the field tell us are worth reading. I will give one quick example because this lady is much maligned in Catholic circles. In fact, and I've lectured on her before, someone recently posted a comment about me saying, "When is he going to wake up?" And that's because I love the American writer Flannery O'Connor, who was a very devout Catholic, who by gum gave us the time she lived in there in the Protestant South, who told astonishing truths in surprising, new, original, creative, and disturbing ways. Why would one want to be disturbed about the modern world? It's such a pleasant place. It's so nice. Her constant comment was, "The modern world is so removed from God that he can only reach certain souls through violence, smacking them on the head." And as a result, she shows self-possessed, closed off, isolated, proud individuals in the modern world who think they are fine and need a good swift kick in the derriere, French word, a good swift kick in the derriere to wake them up, and sometimes need even more than that. I will quote a well-known bishop who has said that modern man is going to be taken by God and shaken like a rat in the mouth of a dog. That's what it's going to take to wake up modern man. Flannery O'Connor would agree with him, and she showed it happening in individual cases. Too many traditional Catholics don't like her because she's not nice, she's not sweet, she's not pious. She doesn't write pretty little stories that they can read to their children. And I say, read to the children the lovely little stories, but grown-ups need the truth. And this lady told hard truths. And if you don't like them, the fault is not hers. The fault is the world's. So there's my diatribe to begin this talk. Anyway, just a little bit of my own background with Dickens. Dickens was hugely, hugely important in my life. I've told this story before, but when we get old, we get to tell stories over and over again. It's my dear departed mother had about half a dozen stories that my brother and I, when she started them, we'd roll our eyes because they would come up on a regular basis. So I'm entitled. Anyway, when I was a young reader, and I read a good bit, throughout 5th grade, 6th grade, 7th grade, 8th grade, I read two things. I read murder mysteries, and I read comic books.
And I read voraciously. But I can honestly say I read nothing of any substance whatsoever. But I did form a reading habit. And then when I was in 8th and 9th grade, I had the same teacher, God rest her soul, her name was Marie Cahill, C-A-H-I-L-L. And she was a devout Catholic lady. Why she didn't become a nun, I don't know. In any case, she was teaching in the public school, but she was about 5'10" or 11", straight-backed, white hair, very serious, and that ruler was already always in her hand to whack us on any occasion. She was a legend in the school, and people were terrified of her because she was a disciplinarian. She made everyone work hard, and she insisted that you learn in her classes. Now, I will come back to this in just a moment. Being authoritarian and being a disciplinarian is much rejected in today's world, and she was that. In Dickens, and I'm going to talk about it in a little bit, we have a character, and this is a type that appears over and over in Dickens, that is authoritarian, disciplinarian, and an awful character among the bad people in Dickens. And the difference is this. You can do all those things, and you must do all those things, but when you do them, they must be conjoined with love. And this good Catholic lady loved her students. Before she worked them hard and before she disciplined them, we all knew there was love there. Well, she took a special shine to me, and part of her love was she started slipping me books. Books that were worth reading. The first one she gave me was The Mysterious Island by Jules Verne, and I was fascinated by it. It was much more exciting than the things I'd been reading. And then, when she saw I was hooked instantly, she handed me a book called David Copperfield, and my life changed forever. I have probably read it half a dozen times in my life. I taught it a few times. Every time I read it or teach it, I'm back to being in the eighth grade and having that joy and delight and excitement of meeting that populated world and all those characters and reading that story and laughing and weeping, and the world became a much bigger, much more interesting place. And then she handed me Shakespeare, and with the whole class, we spent 9 weeks on The Merchant of Venice. And my life changed forever. The good lady gave me my profession. I owe her everything. And I sometimes wonder if maybe providentially, one reason she didn't become a nun and didn't teach in Catholic schools is God was so good as to allow me to have her as a teacher. I thank him for her. So I have loved David Copperfield for a long, long time. And shortly after I read the book, many of you know there are countless film and TV adaptations of all the Dickens novels. Most of them are really very, very good. They're worth your time. They're very good. I have a favorite, and I'll mention it. It was made by MGM out of Hollywood in the mid-1930s. And old Sam Goldwyn had the brilliant idea of using one of the studio's great stars and putting him in the role of what is considered to be the greatest comic character Dickens ever created, Wilkins Micawber in David Copperfield, based on Dickens' own father, John Dickens. Wilkins Micawber, every one of the great, there are three great comic characters undisputed in literature. One, Shakespeare's Falstaff in Henry IV, parts 1 and 2, and a little bit in Merry Wives, but mostly two parts of Henry IV. And Falstaff is a delight because he shows us the tendency of the eternal child, the one who doesn't ever grow up, and in spite of all of his naughtiness, which is profound, in spite of all of his flaws, we love him because he's a child. Number two, the great Don Quixote. idealism that is so profound it leads to madness, but we forgive it because the idealism is correct half the time. And if it's stark raving mad half the time, that's a pretty good score. 50% is pretty good, and we forgive him the other 50%. Wilkins Micawber is the ultimate in human nature because he is a walking exaggeration, especially in his emotions. He is, as Dickens' father, John Dickens, was, the ultimate manic depressive. There is no middle ground. He is either extraordinarily upbeat and happy, or he is plunged into the depths of despair and then multiplies it tenfold, and there's nothing in the middle. There is a wonderful scene in Copperfield where David has just seen the Micawber family. They're leaving town. He cannot manage his money. They are always in debt. And there has been a heartbreaking farewell, and Micawber is sure he's off to debtor's prison. His life is over. He is ruined. And David, the young David, is heartsick, and then a few minutes later sees the Micawber family on the back of a cart going down the street, and Mr. Micawber is singing and joking and laughing with a big smile on his face, and young David cannot grasp it at all, can't understand what's going on. Such a thing is a mystery, but God bless Micawber. Anyway, Sam Goldwyn brought in the great comic actor of the age, W.C. Fields, and had him play Micawber, and it is the perfect match of an actor with a role. Absolutely brilliant. When he signed the contract, Fields had one problem. He went into Sam Goldwyn and said, yes, I'll do the part, but I see one problem with the script. And Sam said, what's that, Bill? And Fields said, they've left out the juggling act. And Goldwyn said, Bill, there's no juggling in David Copperfield. Micawber doesn't juggle. And Fields said, oh, he probably forgot it. I learned later that Fields, on his bedside, kept a complete set of Dickens and just read it from cover to cover. It's the only books he ever read. He was Dickensian. If you see the film, he is the quintessential magnificent Wilkins Micawber. The first hour of the film is magnificent, magnificent. First 150 pages, then they try to cram 650 pages into the second hour. You can barely tell what's happening. But anyway, watch it for the first hour. And also, and I'll get to this later, a wonderful old Hollywood character actress named Edna Mae Oliver, who is Betsy Trotwood. Absolutely is Betsy Trotwood. One of the great performances ever. So more about our friend Betsy Trotwood in a moment. In high school, I had a friend whose father had been in World War II, stationed in India, and came back with a terrible ear infection that left him dead, deaf, all sorts of diseases inside that the doctors couldn't even diagnose. Who knows what he'd picked up? And the poor man was ill for the rest of his life, another 40 plus years. And he worked building tires in a tire factory, a very hard and tough job. I'll talk about that tomorrow when I get to Dickens' Coke Town and what it means to work in a factory in the modern world. But I learned he read one book a year. Every year, he only read one book, and it was David Copperfield. And I said to him once, Mr. Nadler, you know, Dickens wrote many, many other novels that I'm sure you'd enjoy. He said, oh, I don't doubt that I would, but I love this one. And once a year, he read the same book over and over again. My brother's not a reader, but I did push David Copperfield on him once, and he took his time, he read it over, and at the end of it, he finally announced he'd finished. I said, well, what do you think? He said, I'm very upset. I said, what's wrong? He said, it ended. And it's the way many of us feel about Dickens novels. It's a shame when they end. One last little quick introductory point. I had to give up reading, teaching Dickens in my classroom because it was too difficult for my midshipmen to read. And it's not that they weren't bright enough, they certainly were. I often taught honors students. But here is the problem. Dickens wrote in a time when there was leisure. You know, Aristotle says that it's necessary for a human action to be in three parts: work, play, and leisure. Okay, we know what work is. Play is quite literally getting out and having some activity and exercising a bit, doing something, taking away. But leisure is that time that allows us to appreciate a little music, a little poetry, take a walk and look at nature. That is leisure time. The modern world has crushed leisure time, and the play is now on big screen TVs in sports bars and is filled with advertisements. And the work, again, I'll talk about tomorrow, has become soul-crushing for most people. In the 19th century, people had a little leisure time. They could read Dickens. They had the time. It's hard for us to do, so I make two recommendations for you, for your children, and the first is this. As Dickens published his novels serially in parts, that is, once a month, usually there would appear a single part of the novel, usually 3 to 4 chapters, and then there would be a month's wait until the next 3 or 4 chapters came out. That is the way to read him now. Not pick up an enormous 880-page book and try to go from cover to cover. You're going to be intimidated, run out of time, at some point put it down and not be able to get through it. But it's very easy to find. You look up what parts, which chapters, chapters 1, 2, 3, and at the beginning of the month, you read those for the month. You can read 3 chapters in a month. Sometimes you might want to read them twice. They often did that at the time. And then as you work your way slowly through the novel, you will have time to actually read it and appreciate it. And the second thing to do is this. Get together with someone and read it aloud. Read it aloud. The father of the house would often sit down when the new Dickens episode came in and would read aloud to his family. There's a wonderful story of the young American writer Henry James. Copperfield was coming out, and his father thought young Henry was too young to listen to it, sent him to bed, and Henry James was in turmoil knowing there was this wonderful book his father was reading the rest of the family, and he describes feeling very naughty as he crept out of his bed, crawled on the balcony up above the living room where his father was reading, and sat hiding behind the rails in terror he'd be caught, but not being able to go back to bed because he was able to listen to his father reading Copperfield to the rest of the family. Now, there's a devoted Dickens reader, okay? In any case, read it aloud. The other wonderful thing is, I taught writing for 40 years. At the end of the 40 years, I finally figured out how to teach writing. You can't teach writing starting when young people are 18, 19, 20. Too late. And I used to think you can teach writing by having them read. That's not how you do it. I discovered that those who can write are able to write because they were read aloud to when they were young. They had parents who read aloud to them. As faith comes by hearing, we are told, the ability to write comes by hearing. And something about hearing the sentences, the patterns, the words, go somewhere deep into the child's soul, mind, whatever. And then later they can reproduce the patterns and they will be writers. Best thing you can do for your children, read aloud to them. Start with the simple things. Let it become a little more complex, but if you read Dickens aloud to your children, they are going to be better writers when they grow up. Simple fact. Simple fact. Well, with all that, now I can get to my subject. See, this is my problem. It takes me forever to get where I'm going, especially now that I'm older, a whole lot older. Okay. as has been mentioned, Broadstairs was a special place for Dickens, a very special place. A number of the books were written here. He wrote portions of Pickwick Papers here. That means he discovered it when he was fairly young. Pickwick Papers was his first enormous success. And you cannot imagine what a hit it was in England. Everyone was reading Pickwick. And he said he overnight became a national treasure. Some of that was written here. He wrote portions of Nicholas Nickleby here. He wrote some of Oliver Twist here. He wrote portions of The Old Curiosity Shop here. He wrote some of Dombey and Son here, and he wrote large chunks of David Copperfield here. This was a Dickens town, and he brought his family here. He loved the sea. He loved everything about it. And for a writer, it's very important to find the right place to write. And something about Broadstairs brought out the creative in Dickens in the same way. T.S. Eliot, who was writing The Wasteland, had a terrible writer's block. He'd started the poem. It wasn't going well. He visited a little pavilion in Margate, sitting at the pavilion, and suddenly the writer's block vanished, and he was able to write 40 to 50 lines of the poem. They just came like that. And they are in the final text. The writer's block was broken. Something about the place, the sea, the air, it's a mystery. Well, and of course, the inspiration. Any writer will tell you it depends on, it's called the muse, but we know what that means as Catholics. It's God's good inspiration. And he sends things in his own good time, not ours. And that's true for all of us in every way. I'm going to just read a little description. This is from Peter Ackroyd's biography of Dickens, talking about the first visit to Broadstairs. Dickens first fell in love with a young woman named Maria Beadnell. It was a youthful passion. And she sort of returned it. She was interested in him. At that time, he was a court reporter. His fame at that point was he wrote the quickest shorthand of anyone in England. He was a master at shorthand. So he got to know her, fell in love, but the Beadnell family realized this is just a court reporter. There's not much of a future. They hoped better for their daughter, and they took her away, took her to Europe. And he was heartbroken, and she wrote a few times, and then when she came back, it had worked, and she was above him, and it ended. There is a very funny scene in Dickens' Little Dorrit, where the hero meets a young woman that he had been in love with many years before, and he realizes she's in the area, and they write each other, and he's going to see her again. Her name is Flora Finching. And they decide to have lunch, and they meet for lunch, and she has put on a good bit of weight, as many of us do as we grow older. She is very silly, an absolute little airhead, God help her, and still thinks of herself as a beautiful 16-year-old. It's an uproariously funny portraiture. I hope poor Maria never read it. In any case, following that, he married a woman named Catherine Hogarth. And her younger sister, Mary, came to live with him. And Dickens had a profound attachment to Mary Hogarth, who indeed suddenly became very ill and died in his arms at the age of 18. It shattered him. It shattered the whole Hogarth family. And it was in the aftermath of that that he made his first visit to Broadstairs. I quote from Mr. Ackroyd. He had gone down with the family to Broadstairs at the end of August, taking with them Mrs. Hogarth, Mary's mother, who had still not recovered from her daughter's sudden death 4 months before. It is not known why he chose Broadstairs, but even today it has an air of enclosure, of being cut off, which may have appealed to him after the arduous engagements and negotiations in London. They took a small two-story wooden house with its parlor overlooking the High Street, which, as it does still, slopes steeply downwards to the sea, which was no more than 3 minutes away. This place had been fashionable in the late 18th century, but was now once more a quiet fishing village, built upon the steep chalk cliffs, which overlook a semicircular bay with its pleasant sands and short wooden pier. Clearly, Dickens liked it here. He fell ill, but recovered quickly and became acquainted with the landlord of Ballard's Hotel, which overlooked the sea. He walked the few miles along the sands to Ramsgate and joined the local subscription library. The main point, however, was that Broadstairs was secluded and it was quiet, conditions in which Dickens could rest and also work. He liked it so much, in fact, that he and his family returned there in the summer or autumn months for almost 14 years. It may even have been Dickens's presence there that made it more popular. Some years later, Punch magazine described it as, quote, a shrine to which certain fashionable people make a yearly pilgrimage in order to take penance. Particularly, it was favored by theatrical people, a group very close to Dickens's heart, but at no point did it become a resort in the 20th century sense. There was no such phenomenon then. Travelers either did the grand tour of Europe or they migrated to the health spas. Bath, for example, was very popular at the time. In Broadstairs, Dickens would have seen only a place of refuge after the cares of the metropolis, and in particular, a place where he could resume his contemplation of the sea. Now, it makes sense. He was able to write. He was able to write here. But beyond that, some other curious things happened in Broadstairs. It was here that he got the inspiration to begin A Christmas Carol, probably his most famous work. And as we were walking from the train station, I pointed out to His Excellency there is a little shop here called Marley's. And it was indeed one night while he was here in Broadstairs, he had a little dream in which the name Marley came to him, and the opening of the work, Marley was dead to begin with, and the phrase, as dead as a doornail, which has now entered the common language. And that was the impetus, and he began writing A Christmas Carol. Now, what he probably had forgotten is that he stole that phrase from Shakespeare. It actually first appears in Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 2, at the very end of Act 5, where Pistol shows up in Warwickshire and says to Falstaff, "The old king is dead, dead as a doornail." Okay, no, as nail in door, he says. As nail in door. I'm sure Dickens knew it and had been filed away somewhere, and out it came again. Now, why is Dickens remembered? Well, for a number of reasons, and one is this. I'm quoting from the great G.K. Chesterton. Because Dickens created things that no other writer could have ever created. And especially thousands, and I'm not joking in that number, thousands of characters, many of whom are the most memorable in all of literature. He was also, without a doubt, one of the greatest storytellers of all time. The reason that he is still read is because he tells a great story. And as I have said repeatedly, so I'll say it again, we know that God himself put stories and the love of stories in our hearts. Because when his son came to earth and walked among us and taught us, he did not teach us in syllogisms or philosophical treatises. What he taught with most often was parables. And the parable is a little short story. So that God intended his son to teach mankind the ultimate truths through stories. And in order for us to understand it, he had to have put in our hearts a love for stories and an ability to understand stories, which is why deep inside, from the time we are very little, The two-year-old climbs up on his grandfather's knee and says, "Tell me a story, Grandpa." It's why before they go to bed at night, the children aren't only trying to delay going to sleep. They also want to hear a story. Tell me a story before I go to sleep. Tell me another one. Tell me that. Then we get into the delaying tactics, okay? But the impulse is to hear a story before going to sleep. That's what the children want. That is absolutely natural. And stories are still told. One of the serious problems of the age is that we're losing storytellers. People don't know how to construct, authors can't construct plots anymore. The movies, which are a second-rate art form, as I call them, the bastard marriage between art and technology, meaning that when the power goes out, there'll be no, all the movies will be lost, whereas we can still read Copperfield or get a few people together and do our own production of Twelfth Night, but Gone with the Wind will be gone with the wind. Nevertheless, the old, again, the studio bosses insisted on one thing above all, and that was story. If you were going to make a movie, there had to be a good story. They needed some film stars as well, but they wanted a good story, and they would bring in real writers. It's tough. It's tough to find storytellers now. It was Shaw. If you, dear English, blessed us with Chaucer and Shakespeare and Dickens, you also did give us Shaw, who did write a few good things, to be fair, but Shaw said, plot is the bane of the serious artist. He didn't want to be bothered with storytelling. And yet, curiously enough, probably the play he's most famous for, called Pygmalion, turned into that very good American musical called My Fair Lady, has a wonderful story. And in fact, it's the fact that it's such a good story that has made it so popular. So, fortunately, he was contradictory enough to give us a few good stories. Dickens was a great storyteller. A great storyteller. But it was more than that. The nature of the stories themselves were very appealing at the time and remain extremely appealing. Many criticize him for this, but I don't think that, while it is accurate, I don't believe it's a fair criticism. Dickens was a man who loved the theater. Went to the theater constantly, always did amateur theatricals, tried to write some plays. They were terrible. I'll say a word about that later. They were not successful. It's very odd. But the plays he saw when he was young that had a great influence on him were often melodramas in which the storyline is exaggerated and you have very clear moral values presented in an exaggerated form. The good tend to be very good. The bad tend to be very bad. And at the end of the work, the good triumph, the end get their just deserts, and we all feel happy about that because it's what is we all hope for in a way is God's justice. So that those good things we have done, we hope to be rewarded for, and the other things that we know we've done, God have mercy on us, we hope God will have mercy on us. And as a result, well, as Oscar Wilde mocks it in his delightful play, The Importance of Being Earnest, Miss Prism, teaching Sicily, her student says, Describing the reading of novels, she said, it's where the good end happily, the bad end unhappily. That's why we call it fiction, which is Wilde being very amusing, but nevertheless. So Dickens, I think, was imbued with melodrama and took that sense of exaggerated goodness, exaggerated badness, and used it in a profound way in telling his stories. And there was one other thing, though, and this is what made him an artist. You do not know in a Dickens novel if the good will remain good all the way through or fall, and some of the most moving moments in all of his works are those moments when a character who has been either distinctly evil or proud or bad or ill-natured through a moment of grace repents and changes his ways. It's the glory of Scrooge in A Christmas Carol. That old, wizened, cranky miser who had cut himself off from his fellow human beings at the very end as a result of the visits from the three ghosts has a complete transformation, and our joy in seeing a dead soul come back to life is so thrilling that it has become, I call it, the only modern myth. And by that I mean it is a story that has affected us so deeply, it keeps being done over and over and over again. Most theaters earn their money for the year by doing productions of Christmas Carol at Christmas time. Endless film versions. It keeps reappearing, and there's a reason for that. I'll say a little more about Scrooge and A Christmas Carol later, but there it is. But there are others, many other. It's one of my favorite moments in David Copperfield. There is the character who lives with the Peggotty family in Yarmouth. Her name is Mrs. Gummidge. She's been a widow for a long time, and it's embittered her. And she sits in a corner and just repeats over and over again, "I'm a lone creature, and everything goes contrary with me," and feels sorry for herself constantly. They're very kind to her, but you as the reader want her to shut up. Because whenever she opens her mouth, that's, "I'm a lone creature, and everything goes contrary with me." Enough. But God bless the Peggotty family. They're very indulgent. At the time when they're leaving, when tragedy has struck the Peggotty family, she suddenly turns to Daniel Peggotty, and they're leaving the little boat, and she says, "Take me with you, Daniel. I'll do anything. I won't complain anymore. But don't leave me. Take..." Becomes fully human, reaches out, connects with those people she's loved all along, but was too self-indulgent to it. Oh, it's just incredibly moving. He was a master at that. Dickens believed in possible redemption for every human soul. No matter how bad or low or sinful a character was, Dickens believed in the possibility of the redemption of that soul. And that's something you want and must give to your children. And in the modern world, keep reading for yourself, because times are going to get tougher, much tougher. And no matter what happens or how it happens, you've got to remember, redemption is always possible if you open yourself to it and ask for it. It's there. Now, the other thing about the theater, Dickens learned there the importance of drawing vivid characters. Something he got from the theater, along with the narrative, that melodramatic narrative. He also, of course, got that from a pile of books he found in one of the homes that they rented briefly when he was young. He found the Arabian Nights. He found Don Quixote. He found Robinson Crusoe. He found the Tobias Smollett novels. Smollett's Forgotten. They're wonderful. It's forgotten now, but they're good stories. Peregrine Pickle and anyway, there are a whole series of them. And he read those and discovered the importance of story. In any case, also in the theater, he discovered character, larger-than-life characters. And I'm convinced one reason that Dickens became a novelist rather and couldn't work in the theater is the nature of the building of the theater itself at the time. If he had had Shakespeare's open stage, we went to the Old Globe, the new-built Old Globe in London. Terrible production of Antony and Cleopatra last night. Just stinky. Ooh, But nevertheless, they have rebuilt the theater. Open space, audience close to the actors, and an actor cannot be too big on that stage because there's no roof, there are no walls. The audience surrounds the actor. And it's the reason Shakespeare could write those great, huge roles with that great poetry, because it was even open air. The emotions could just soar upward and outward. It was astonishing. So he was, his greatest actor, it had to be one of the greatest actors ever, Richard Burbage, who originated Brutus in Julius Caesar, Hamlet, Othello, Lear, Macbeth, Antony, Prospero. I mean, and these roles were written for that actor. He had to have been an enormous stage presence. By the way, on his little tombstone, it was buried. It's lost now. It just said, "Exit Burbage." Which I just read that recently. I found it a hoot. Anyway. But Dickens Theater was a picture box theater. That proscenium arch, with the seats looking down at the little picture box and the curtain would close, that was too small a space for Dickens' imagination. He needed 900 blank pages to hold all of his creation. This enormous, overspilling, fertile, never-ending creation. The thousands of characters of great size. And rather than poetry, because the poetry was with the Romantic poets, and he was doing something different, but by gum, he could write beautiful prose. And there are throughout Dickens, I should have written some down, but I didn't. I didn't think of it till just now. There are passages in Dickens that you can turn into iambic pentameter. They have the rhythm. He was so immersed in Shakespeare that occasionally at high moments he actually writes in blank verse. By the way, Melville does the same thing in Moby Dick. Before writing Moby Dick, Melville had immersed himself in King Lear and Macbeth. And there are passages in Moby Dick where Melville starts writing in iambic pentameter. So anyway, it was in Dickens and he was writing that way. But the characters couldn't be contained by that little picture box stage. His imagination was larger than that. So what he does, and remember this, we have the melodrama, the enormous size, the storytelling, these immense characters. And he also began, and I mentioned already, as a court reporter. And the reason, it wasn't just the shorthand that he could jot things down quickly, he had an eye for characterization and apparently was able to render in a few broad strokes what he saw happening there in Parliament and occasionally in the courts. He could vividly create characters instantly, which means, this is interesting, he was also a realist, because he could use specific details, he could see a person, take a few of the specific details of the looks, the speech, the manner of dress, and he wouldn't just reproduce it, but his imagination would work on it, or he would combine two or three characters, or his own father, and turn that vivid impression into a living, breathing, enormous personality that fills the pages. But it begins with a kind of realism that he then exaggerates through melodrama into a kind of romanticism. He was there at the end of the age of romanticism. And we get this odd combination of realism and romanticism that work together to create the Dickensian world of the novels. Now, he himself, to a degree, was aware, I think, of what he had done in David Copperfield. It was his most personal book. There are things that he puts in the pages of that book that he had never written about before. At one point, he started an autobiography and abandoned it. And what he did instead was take his own early days as a boy and turn that into fiction. And he himself becomes the little boy David Copperfield at the beginning of that book. It was an ability to get into the mind of a child that I don't think any other writer has ever had. He does it twice. He does it in David Copperfield. He does it again with Pip in Great Expectations. No author has ever rendered the world through a child's eyes the way that Dickens did. How did he do it? I think, to be quite honest, in a very real sense, he never grew up. There was something of the child in him always, always, and he never lost it. It was there permanently. It was a difficult childhood. His father was always in debt. They were always moving. He didn't get a formal education. His sister was given one, but he wasn't. He felt deprived because of that. He was lucky enough to find those books and read the books and was lost in the world of the imagination and storytelling. But at the age of 12, and this was the crucial event in his life, because the family was so poor, he was sent to work in a blacking factory. It was a factory that made boot black. And his job as a 12-year-old, working 10 to 12 hours a day, was to wash the blacking bottles, clean them, and then put a new label on them. He was humiliated. He hated the work. He couldn't bear it. And then, when his father had a fight with the owner of the factory, and he was released from it, his own mother was furious and demanded the boy be sent back to the blacking factory again. But his father, God bless him, refused to do so. It haunted him the rest of his life. Some claim it turned him into a snob. I don't think it was that at all. I think it was simply a recognition of the pain a child can go through being put in difficult, embarrassing, hard situations. And he was one of those, you probably know this, that had an enormous part to play in getting reform of the child labor laws in England. And much of it came about as a result of what he wrote. So that had haunted him. And indeed, he puts it down in David Copperfield. David is sent to work in a bottling factory where they're redoing wine bottles. So it's not exact, but it's close enough. And the boy's humiliated, just humiliated by it. At the end of his life, when the last complete edition of all of his works came out before his death, he wrote new introductions to them all. And before David Copperfield, he writes very simply, as with all parents, I love all my children. But also, as a fond parent, in my heart of hearts, I have a favorite child. And his name is David Copperfield. So we know Dickens loved this book above all others of his own creation. It was that close to him. Now, okay, I can just about do this. Yeah, we've got half an hour. Yeah, I think that's about what it will take. I'll come close there. Micawber's magnificent. But the first of the great characters we meet in Copperfield, in the very first chapter, is Aunt Betsy Trotwood. The aunt of David Copperfield Sr., who is deceased before the novel begins. David's mother is about to give birth to him. We are very close to the moment of birth. Appropriately, the first chapter is entitled, I Am Born. So we know what it's about. And suddenly, out of nowhere, shows up this very peculiar lady who turns out to be David Sr.'s aunt, who is there because she has learned that there will be a new Copperfield coming into the family, and she is totally convinced it will be a lovely little girl who will be named Betsy Trotwood Copperfield. Well, the time comes, and Dr. Chillip shows up to assist at the birth, and has to deal with this rather strong-willed, eccentric woman who's explaining to him what the child will be and what it will be named, and there's no doubt about it, and she's not sure she trusts this doctor to deliver that wonderful little girl, and it's a very funny scene. And, of course, the moment comes, the baby is delivered, Dr. Chillip walks out and announces it's a boy. And Aunt Betsy takes her bonnet and beats him over the head with it and goes storming off into the night. And we don't see her again for many, many chapters. It's obviously a severe disappointment to her. But she is one of those Dickens figures that we love precisely because of the eccentricities. Chesterton refers to her this way. I love it. Aunt Betsy Trotwood is an erect and sardonic spinster, mad in small things, but so sane in great ones. In fact, it's a wonderful definition of eccentricity. Totally mad in the little affairs of life, but having sanity in the most important ones, okay? Many of us might qualify. when you've been reading a lot of Dickens, you start seeing everybody around you as a Dickensian character. And then occasionally one looks in the mirror and sees a Dickens character staring back at you, and you suddenly realize you're a bundle of mannerisms and peculiarities and speech habits and peculiar appearance. And years ago, before I went to the Naval Academy, I taught for a year in the theater department at the university in the town where I was raised, University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. And I was teaching theater history and some drama courses. Well, it came to the end of the year, and it was the big theater banquet. And it was a good time, and we're all there, all the theater students and the faculty. And the acting students are getting up and doing little sketches and whatnot, and it's all very funny, and everyone's having a good time. And suddenly, one young man gets up, and all he has is a little styrofoam coffee cup. And all he's doing is walking back and forth in front of everybody and talking. And they're all roaring, just roaring with laughter. Just uproarious laughter. And I turned to the gentleman sitting next to me, who was the costume designer in the theater, and I said to him, "What are they laughing at?" He said, "He's doing you." And all of a sudden I looked and suddenly realized, yeah, the coffee cup, the walk, the thing to the head, the speech patterns, and I realized I'm a Dickens character. I'm a Dickens character. Well, David's fortunes decline. I'm going to do my best not to give away too much plot as I discuss these novels. It's a terrible thing to do. But certain things I will only reveal plot where absolutely necessary. That's the guarantee I make you. In any case, David's fortunes decline. His mother remarries and remarries a ghastly man, appropriately named Mr. Murdstone. I think it's a combination of a French word, slightly altered. and let's just say he's very hard and full of it. In any case, he comes with an even equally ghastly sister, Miss Jane Murdstone, and they drive the poor, young, weak widow to an early grave. And David is left in their care. And Mr. Murdstone detests David. They have an encounter before his mother dies. It's one of the great scenes in Dickens. Mr. Murdstone is beating the child unmercifully, unmercifully. And David, as any poor animal would do when being beaten, bites Mr. Murdstone's finger and is never forgiven for it. And from that moment, there is animosity between stepfather and stepson. And it is the Murdstones who send David to the factory, to work in the factory, and send him to Mr. Creakle's school, one of those ghastly Dickens schools where there's no education, there's barely survival. And again, Dickens was important in education reform in England. I'll say more about that with Hard Times tomorrow. And finally, David realizes he can bear it no longer and runs away, but has nowhere to go. He doesn't know where to go. I'm going to pick this up, and now I'm going to read a little, just settle back, because at this point we have to allow the master to speak for himself. He makes his way to Dover. Aunt Betsy Trotwood has a place in Dover. It's a terrible journey. Awful things happen to him on the way, but he knows no one else. He remembers she had been kind to his mother and thought well of his father. It is one moment of human generosity. And even though he knows that poor Dr. Chillip got the heat of her bonnet, he'll willingly suffer a bonnet attack rather than war with the Murdstones, okay? So he goes there. He comes to the house on the green in Dover and is looking in the windows and sees this curious round face from up above, isn't sure what's there. I was on the point of slinking off to think how I had best proceed when there came out of the house a lady with her handkerchief tied over her cap and a pair of gardening gloves on her hands, wearing a gardening pocket like a toll man's apron and carrying a great knife. By the way, all Dickens novels approach fairy tales, okay? So suddenly we see this creature, and we're not sure about her. She's carrying a knife. I knew her immediately to be Miss Betsy, for she came stalking out of the house, exactly as my poor mother had so often described her, stalking up our garden at Blunderstone Rookery. Whoop, there we go. Whoop. Just, there we go, got it. "Go away," said Miss Betsy, shaking her head and making a distant chop in the air with the knife. "Go along. No boy is here." I watched her with my heart at my lips as she marched to a corner of her garden and stooped to dig up some little root there. Then, without a scrap of courage but with a great deal of desperation, I went softly in and stood beside her, touching her with my finger. "If you please, ma'am," I began. She started and looked up. "If you please, aunt?" "Eh?" exclaimed Miss Betsy, in a tone of amazement I have never heard approached. "If you please, aunt, I am your nephew." "Oh, Lord," said my aunt, and she sat flat down in the garden bath. "I am David Copperfield of Blunderstone in Suffolk, where you came on the night when I was born and saw my dear mama. I have been very unhappy since she died. I have been slighted and taught nothing and thrown upon myself and put to work not fit for me. It made me run away to you. I was robbed at first setting out and have walked all the way and have never slept in a bed since I began the journey." Here my self-support gave way all at once, and with a movement of my hands intended to show her my ragged state and call it to witness that I had suffered something, I broke into a passion of crying, which I suppose had been pent up within me all week. My aunt, with every sort of expression but wonder discharged from her countenance, sat on the gravel, staring at me until I began to cry. When she got up in a great hurry, collared me and took me into the parlor. Her first proceeding there was to unlock a tall press, bring out several bottles, and pour some of the contents of each into my mouth. I think they must have been taken out at random, for I am sure I tasted aniseed water, anchovy sauce, and salad dressing. When she had administered these restoratives, as I was still quite hysterical and unable to control my sobs, she put me on the sofa with a shawl under my feet and the handkerchief from her own head under my feet, lest I should sully the cover. And then sitting herself down beside the green fan or screen I have already mentioned, so that I could not see her face, ejaculated at intervals, "Mercy on us!" letting those exclamations off like minute guns. After a time, she rang the bell. "Janet," said my aunt, when her servant came in, "go upstairs, give my compliments to Mr. Dick, and say I wish to speak with him. Janet looked a little surprised to see me lying stiffly on the sofa, but went on her errand. My aunt, with her hands behind her, walked up and down the room until the gentleman who had squinted at me from the upper window came in laughing. "Mr. Dick," said my aunt, "don't be a fool, because nobody can be more discreet than you can when you choose. We all know that, so don't be a fool, whatever you are." "Mr. Dick," said my aunt, "you have heard me mention David Copperfield. Now don't pretend not to have a memory, because you and I know better." "David Copperfield," said Mr. Dick, who did not appear to me to remember much about it. "David Copperfield? Oh, yes, to be sure. David, certainly." "Well," said my aunt, "this is his boy, his son. He would be as like his father as it is possible to be if he was not so like his mother, too." "His son," said Mr. Dick. "David's son, indeed." "Well, then," returned my aunt, "Dick, when you are as sharp as a surgeon's lance now, you see here young David Copperfield, and the question I put to you is, what shall I do with him?" "What shall you do with him?" said Mr. Dick feebly, scratching his head. "Oh, do with him. Yes," said my aunt with a grave look, and her forefinger held up. "Come, I want some sound advice." "Why, if I was you," said Mr. Dick, considering and looking vacantly at me, "I should..." The contemplation of me seemed to inspire him with a sudden idea, and he added briskly, "I should wash him." "Janet," said my aunt, turning round with a quiet triumph, which I did not then understand, "Mr. Dick sets us all right. Heat the bath." It is simply incomparable. It's simply incomparable. Now, the scene goes on. That's just a little snippet of it. But it gives you a sense. There are three characters, just fully created. Little bits of dialogue, but it's the dramatic situation that's set up as well. And then, here we go, and this is very important for what you're going to see very soon. Jane had gone to get the bath ready when my aunt, to my great alarm, became in one moment rigid with indignation and had hardly voiced to cry out, "Janet! Donkeys!" Upon which Janet came running up the stairs as if the house were in flames, darted out on a little piece of green in front, and warned off two saddle donkeys, lady-ridden, that had presumed to set foot upon it, while my aunt, rushing out of the house, seized the bridle of a third animal laden with a bestriding child, turned him, led him forth from those sacred precincts, and boxed the ears of the unlucky urchin in attendance who had dared to profane that hallowed ground. To this hour, I don't know whether my aunt had any lawful right-of-way over that patch of green, but she had settled it in her own mind that she had, and it was all the same to her. The one great outrage of her life, demanding to be constantly avenged, was the passage of a donkey over that immaculate spot. In whatever occupation she was engaged, however interesting to her the conversation in which she was taking part, a donkey turned the current of her ideas in a moment, and she was upon him straight. Jugs of water and watering pots were kept in secret places, ready to be discharged on the offending boys. Sticks were laid up in ambush behind the door. Sallies were made at all hours, and incessant war prevailed. Perhaps this was an agreeable excitement to the donkey boys, or perhaps the more sagacious of the donkeys, understanding how the case stood, delighted with constitutional obstinacy in coming that way. I only know that there were three alarms before the bath was ready, and that on the occasion of the last and most desperate of all, I saw my aunt engage single-handed with a sandy-headed lad of 15 and bump his sandy head against her own gate before he seemed to comprehend what was the matter. Now, Aunt Betsy writes to the Murdstones and lets them know that David is there. And, of course, they come to Aunt Betsy Trotwood's cottage. I will not read it. I don't want to spoil it for you. You owe it to yourselves. Needless to say, they arrive on donkeys and cross over that patch of green. So that the initial meeting between Betsy Trotwood and Mr. and Miss Murdstone is already sullied by a gross indiscretion. And then, God bless her, she gives it to them in one of the great scenes in all of literature. And the fact of the matter is, the Murdstones are a type that Dickens hated, absolutely hated. At heart, there is a touch of the Calvinist about them. They are the elect, and everyone around them is inferior and dispensable. They are the quintessential embodiments of perfect morality, and everybody else is below them and besmirched with sin. They are the upholders of the social order and all that is good in it, and everyone around them is mere trouble and annoyance and part of the destruction of their perfect world. There has always been, in Catholic history, a touch of this. The most recent explosion was probably the Jansenism that took place. There is a tendency in all of us to think on occasion too well of ourselves. A very good corrective, if you get a touch of that, is to open up David Copperfield and read Betsy Trotwood's response to the Murdstones. It will draw you down a bit. And more than that, at the core of it, is not an eccentric lady who is merely being contrary. It is someone who is eccentric, has her own failings, but is filled with love, no matter how peculiarly she may show it. And if something from the outside that is cold, distant, hard, unloving, uncharitable, unforgiving, should try to block that love or harm an innocent little creature, then it's time to stand up and defend the innocent from such an assault. Aunt Betsy Trotwood speaks for something deep, deep inside Dickens. And it's something very good, because as with all of his greatest characters, it comes out of a profound charity, a deep love of fellows. Actually, I was going to do this now. I will do it later. I'll end this little section by saying one thing. We're going to go to the Dickens Museum here, those of you that can join us. It's housed in what's called Betsy Trotwood's Cottage, because the inspiration for Betsy Trotwood and her cottage comes from Broadstairs. While Dickens was living here, he heard the story of a single lady named Mary Pearson Strong, whose cottage was right near the sea and had a plot of green in front leading down to the sea, who was absolutely impassioned any time a donkey crossed her property and would indeed set the offender right. Now, I don't know if she went as far as all of this. I don't know if she was quite as eccentric, but as I said, Dickens would take the real, capture the basics, exaggerate it, multiply it many times over, make it bigger, and combine the realism of the inspiration with the romanticism of his wonderful imagination, and he left us one of my favorite characters of all time, and one who remains incalculable. Let me give you one other little moment. Oh, I hope I wrote the page down. Let me see if I did. Got a second here before we head out. Oh, no, I don't think I did, but I'll have to find it just the same. Give me just a moment here, and I will get to it. Okay, let me see here. Oh, it's just, I'm back at the Murdstones. As I said, treat yourself. She finds a good schoolmaster for him, Dr. Strong. And she also, as a result, ends up giving, well, I don't want to give the plot away, gives him a future good that he's not aware of at the time. Okay. I am... Whenever you go looking for a page number you haven't written down, you can never, ever find it. But I will... Oh, boy. That's not it. So it must be before this. Oh, yes, here I am. Okay. This is lovely. She takes him to Dr. Strong's and says goodbye. And he's staying with the Wickfield family. She told me that everything would be arranged for me by Mr. Wickfield and that I should want for nothing, and gave me the kindest words and the best advice. "Trot," said my aunt in conclusion, "be a credit to yourself, to me, and Mr. Dick, and heaven be with you." I was greatly overcome and could only thank her again and again and send my love to Mr. Dick. "Never," said my aunt, "be mean in anything. Never be false. Never be cruel. Avoid these three vices, Trot, and I can always be hopeful of you." I promised her as well as I could that I would not abuse her kindness or forget her admonition. "The pony's at the door," said my aunt, "and I am off. Stay here." With these words, she embraced me hastily and went out of the room, shutting the door after her. At first, I was startled by so abrupt a departure and almost feared I had displeased her. But when I looked into the street and saw how dejectedly she got into the chaise and drove away without looking up, I understood her better and did not do her that injustice. Parting is such sweet sorrow that I shall say good night till it be morrow. Yes, anyway. Let's go to the museum.
Sure.
Let's go to the museum.
It's down on the seafront. It's, I guess, about a 15-20 minute walk.